This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin with our week in review and the race for governor as the candidates make their final push with just over a week to go.
People still think, you know, from 2010 that I don't have a sense of humor or I'm too chilly, and I've worked for 4 years to overcome that.
Also this week, with the end of his gubernatorial term in sight, Deval Patrick touts big gains Maine in the public schools under his watch.
The turnaround work is tough, slow, and sometimes controversial, but the results are inspiring.
And another case of Ebola, this time in New York City. Meanwhile, the Boston doctor, tapped to be the next Surgeon General, remains in limbo and loses a critical endorsement.
The likelihood that he would be confirmed is almost nil. And yet, there is great need for the country now to have a confirmed Surgeon General.
And former Mayor Tom Menino ends his chemotherapy treatment and suspends his book tour. But the people closest to him say he remains stoic and reflective.
When he would start to talk about these things, it would always be in the context of, and so many other people have it so much worse.
Joining us now to talk more about these stories and the rest of the week in the news is Dante Ramos. He's deputy editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Hey, Dante.
Hi, Tom. Tom. Anthony, listen to me.
I think you're on point there.
I knew exactly who you were referring to. And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Nice to see you in here, Jim.
Good to be with you.
And Dante and Jim, let's start with the biggest race going on in the state right now, the race for governor, arguably. Some polling indicates that it's a dead heat between Republican Charlie Baker and Democrat Martha Coakley. There are variations in polling. Dante, your paper put out a poll just last night finding that Baker holds a 9-point lead, largely fueled by a swing in independent voters. The Coakley campaign calls that an anomaly. What's your take from where you sit on where things stand in this race?
The Coakley campaign is saying that it's an outlier and that 9-point advantage is higher than we've seen in recent polls. It does look, though, that the trend has been in Baker's direction. The WBUR has a tracking poll that shows pretty consistently for the last couple of months that Coakley has been in the low to mid 40 percentage points, and Baker had been behind. But it seems as though as the undecideds are making up their minds, they're going primarily with him. And just in this last one, he nudged ahead in your poll. He was significantly ahead in our poll. So, you know, you'd have to say that while it might not be a 9-point spread, it does seem to be that he has the initiative.
Right. As you say, it does seem to appear that momentum is moving in his direction, if you believe the polling. Jim Sturgis, your view on this?
Well, I agree with what Dante said. I think decisions are being made. What's interesting is the folks who actually didn't know who they'd support before is declining very fast, and they are breaking largely for Charlie Baker. What's also interesting to me is where he's gaining on the issues, and that is on job creation, on management of the government. I think the management of the government thing is one of these unsung portions of, if you will, the headwinds that Martha Coakley's facing. And that is to say, if you looked at Governor Patrick's performance the first 4 years, I think anyone who looked at it objectively would say there's some pretty impressive stuff that got done. The last 4 years, it just feels like the wheels have come off a bit, whether it's Department of Children and Families, whether it's the healthcare connector. Story after story comes out about mismanagement or not very good management. That's a tough thing for her to deal with because she can't come right out and say, the governor's done a bad job. And so it makes her messaging that much harder.
And it is why I think Charlie Baker spends quite a bit of time talking about his role as a manager, in his view, a strong manager. This week, Coakley and Baker had a debate sponsored by The Globe and GBH. And there was a point where Coakley said she would look to raise taxes on the state's top earners. Here's what she said.
They would be taxes on people who are at the top 2%.
How do you do that? There's no graduated income tax in Massachusetts.
Well, we are exploring ways to do a more graduated income tax. I know this legislature's just done a study on that.
Now, that was Jim Browdy we heard. Dante, your paper attributes some of Baker's success to the surge in ads from the GOP side, either from the GOP proper or outside groups. And they have hit Coakley especially on the taxes issue. Is your sense that Democrats can counter that wave of negative publicity?
It's interesting. There's two very different political species, if you want to call it that, in Massachusetts. There are people who are very concerned about tax issues, and that would include, primarily the business community, primarily conservative voters, maybe outside the greater Boston area. And then you have, a significant contingent of voters, and I guess you'd call them maybe the core Coakley voters, for whom taxes aren't that big of an issue. And the idea of moving to a graduated income tax, that's a subject of conversation in policy circles in large parts of Massachusetts commentariat. And so it's the kind of thing that over the course of a debate probably doesn't sound like much of a faux pas. On the other hand, to a certain type of independent voter who isn't part of the core Coakley coalition, it is something that is probably a warning sign, and it wasn't that surprising that she walked it back pretty quickly.
So matters to some, doesn't matter as much to others.
I want to move on and talk about a race that perhaps I would wager a lot of people aren't paying as close attention to, and that is the race for lieutenant governor. In recent days, we've heard from the Democrat, Steve Carrigan. He's gone after his Republican opponent, Karen Pulido, for her past stance on gay marriage. He made the point that Pulido voted in favor of an effort to ban same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. This week, we talked to Pulido about that, and she said, like many politicians from both parties, her views on the issue have evolved. Here's what she said.
And over the 10 years since that law was put into place here in Massachusetts, I have seen families made up maybe differently than mine that want the same things for their kids and their future. And that's what has brought me in my heart to the full embracement of marriage for everyone.
So, Jim, how about this evolution? I mean, it's one that lots of politicians make, including, we should note, President Obama. Do voters accept that, or is this going to hurt candidates like Pulido?
I think voters accept it because voters themselves have been on that same track. Mm-hmm. They've made that same evolution. If you look at all the polling in the 1990s, pro-gay marriage sentiment was a lot lower than even just 5 years after that and even 5 years ago. So I think many people understand that as we get to know what this looks like, as people become more accustomed to seeing couples together who are same sex, it becomes less of an issue. So I think the evolution isn't that difficult to explain for her.
Right. And Dante, maybe a bigger question about this race is the role of the lieutenant governor in the first place. We haven't had a lieutenant governor here in Massachusetts for over a year. Should we even care about this race? Should we even have a lieutenant governor? What do you think?
Well, the last year and a half have not exactly been an advertisement for the urgency of having a new lieutenant governor. It's a challenge for anybody who runs for that job. You obviously wouldn't do it if you didn't see it as a stepping stone for higher office, but there's a certain humiliation built into the position because you don't have any duties beyond overseeing the governor's council. And so it basically comes down to whatever the lieutenant governor can work out with the governor. Steve Carrigan seems to be interested in doing some of the same things that Tim Murray did, which is being having outreach to state and local
Yeah, he wants to sort of set up an ombudsman's office.
Yeah, exactly. And these are, you know, these are bite-sized initiatives at best that don't provide a lot of visibility to the voters, and it doesn't create many opportunities for the lieutenant governor to stand ahead and say, "Hey, look, I did this." So, the least you could say, or the best you could say about the lieutenant governor is, if the wrong person gets elected, they can't really harm anything.
They can't really harm anything. But Jim Sturgis, it's sort of interesting to note that lieutenant governors, not always, but often go on to higher office. I'm thinking of Jane Swift, Paul Cellucci, John Kerry. There was even a Massachusetts lieutenant governor who went on to be president of the United States, Calvin Coolidge.
That's right. Well, I would say one thing for as regards the attorney general she's running with, Steve Carrigan, that is, given the track record or maybe the traffic record, I wouldn't allow him to be the chauffeur. But the lieutenant governor's not going to change the race, but what can happen? And I think probably Baker's team is in a better situation on this front, and that is to say they're perceived as a team, because they've been running as a team from the get-go. And I think that her vision for being a lieutenant governor is maybe a little bit clearer. I'm not making a judgment about the quality of the candidates, but she has legislative experience that Baker does not really directly have. She can act as a liaison to the legislature, can build trust there in a way that, I guess, you know, if you think about it, Bill Weld had Paul Cellucci did exactly that. And I think that's kind of how they're trying to frame it. Kerrigan's role is a little less defined, I think, in the public mind, but I don't think it makes that much of a difference in the race.
Jim and Dante, I'd like to get you to weigh in on a ballot question. This is the one to repeal the casino law. Now, we've heard a lot of ads from the pro-casino side, which somewhat counterintuitively would be the no vote. But just this afternoon, the repeal side, the anti-casino group, launched its first ad, and here's a bit of that.
Fraud, organized crime, indictments. The corrupt casino culture has come to Massachusetts, and big casinos are spending millions to get their way.
I'm worried what a casino will bring here.
Don't let the casinos buy this election.
Repeal the casino deal.
Dante, your sense of it, sort of this late stage toward the election, could this begin changing minds?
The poll numbers on this have not been all that strong. I mean, the pro-repeal people are definitely have an uphill battle ahead of them. And there's two areas that are in conflict here. There's a general NIMBYness of a lot of Massachusetts voters thinking like, oh, well, I wouldn't necessarily want this around me. On the other hand, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of indignation out there in the electorate yet. The folks that were indicted, as mentioned in the advertisement, were people who owned the land that's being sold to Steve Wynn, and it doesn't quite rise to the level of something that shakes the foundations of government in Massachusetts. So it's a lot of territory to make up. Maybe the ad will make a difference, but I think it's still an uphill battle.
Jim, the repeal the casino side has repeatedly said, you know, we may be dwarfed in terms of money, but we can beat this. We've beat it elsewhere. On the other hand, it seems like the jobs argument, all the jobs the casinos will bring, resonates for some people. Do you have a sense of where you think things stand?
Oh, yeah, I do. I think the casinos will go forward. I don't think they'll be able to repeal it. They've done, 53 or something like that. They have raised, the repeal casino side has raised about a 17th of the amount of money that's been raised by
disparity.
The pro-casino folks. I don't know how much they can run this ad. So short of some scandal breaking in the last week, I think that the casinos will be a reality here. And I think, frankly, the talking point about renovating, rehabilitating land that is contaminated is one that's probably strong for the greater Boston area, frankly.
Well, if question three does pass, it would be the upset of all upsets, that's for sure. Let's move on. Governor Patrick yesterday took a victory lap of sorts in an address at Bunker Hill Community College, where he talked about education and improvements in MCAS testing scores this fall. He focused on efforts to close the achievement gap between students of different ethnicities and socioeconomic backgrounds. Here he is.
We are making demonstrable progress in closing persistent achievement gaps. While we have seen a solid 16-point increase in proficiency in English language arts among white students, we've seen a 24% increase for African American students and a 26% increase for Hispanic students.
So, Jim Sturgis, when the governor describes it like that, it does sound like demonstrable progress. Is he right?
I don't think he's right. Look, if you take a look at the 1993 Education Reform Act, afterwards we had 13 straight years of SAT score improvements. You had Massachusetts student performance skyrocketed to the point we became the number one state in the country in all subjects tested. And we tested internationally among the top six countries in math and science. This is cherry-picking data to some degree. I'm happy to see that data, but here's some stuff that contradicts it. SAT scores are down 20 points from 2006. The 2013 national assessment showed Massachusetts as having a 5-point decline in fourth-grade reading, the largest in the country. MCAS scores in early grades are down. That is the best predictor of future success in college. We're at the place where 57% of our third graders are proficient reading, which is 10 points lower than in 2002. Mm. So you can point to some data, but it's not corroborated by other data. And when I look at assessment data, I like to look at multiple measures because different people control the definition of what proficiency is.
Mm. Dante, I'd love to get your take on this because, you know, we mentioned this appearance by the governor. It had sort of the feel of a victory lap. What do you think? I mean, can he claim improvements in education as part of his legacy?
Well, I want to pick up on something that Jim said about the persistence of these achievement gaps. It's something that, you know, you're basically hearing about that implicitly. When Martha Coakley said in the primary campaign that she wanted to offer universal pre-K to all children in Massachusetts and then but ultimately scaled that back to getting 17,000 children off of a wait list, and Charlie Baker is taking a similar position. That is the reaction to a feeling in education circles that, quite aside from what the governor is saying, there is a persistent achievement gap. There are thousands of children who would benefit from more early intervention. And, you know, as Jim is saying, this softness that you're seeing in some of the test scores for the early grades, it's something that is a source of should be a source of anxiety for the next governor, and is something that we need a solution for. Pre-K is the thing that a lot of people look to, but there are some barriers that.